Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Web Summit is a company from Dublin, Ireland, that holds events across the world. Web Summit in Lisbon, Rise in Hong Kong, and recently Collision in Toronto. Collision bills itself as the fastest growing tech conference in North America. Now in its sixth year, Collision has grown to over 25,000 attendees. Collision has become a crossroads for the world's largest buyers and sellers of technology, alongside many of the world's most disruptive emerging technology companies. So why did Earth Matters go to a tech conference? Technology is often touted as the solution to many of society's problems, including climate change. I went to Collision to attend a stream of panel discussions, presentations, and media conferences billed as Planet Tech, a mashup of environmental organizations and government agencies trying to incorporate tech solutions and work with the tech sector. Here are some of the people I met up with. Chief Stacey Laforme is the elected chief of the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation. Chief Laforme has served his community for over 18 years, being first elected to council in 1999. Laforme came to Collision to open the stage with a land recognition ceremony. I spoke with Chief Laforme shortly after.
Tell us very briefly what you're up to today, what you're doing here today.
I've been invited to come and speak and open the Collision event, the industry event. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping it'll be nice audience.
And you're going to acknowledge the land that we stand on, this being Toronto. Why is that important for reconciliation?
Land acknowledgements are, I like to call them, a beginning of a conversation, right? Because you can't understand very much from a land acknowledgement that's 2 or 3 minutes long, or even if it's 15 minutes long, you can't understand much of the history. And so the acknowledgement is merely an opportunity to start having real conversations and dialogue. If you do not follow up on this kind of thing, then you're wasting everybody's time. I mean, there will be those who will do their own investigation, of course, so that counts for something. But my thing is that it's really on the onus is on the people who provide the conference to make something more of it.
Now, I've been familiar with the Maori in New Zealand and the Aborigines in Australia, and my podcast is called Earth Matters. There are two other podcasts called Earth Matters in both of those countries, and they always open their show with a land acknowledgement, but they've always done that, and New Zealand basically teaches Maori to the kids up until grade 3, so where are we in Canada as far as that's concerned?
That, and I know that those nations face the same kind of struggles that we face in Canada, right? So we're not as far as they are. I mean, the openness and the willingness of the governments to embark on what you call reconciliation has only come to the forefront in the last few years at the most. And the strength behind that ideology of coming together in reconciliation takes a real serious commitment from not only the government but the people of the land as well. And while we're getting there, we're not there yet. So the Maori have a huge advantage. Now, I'm used to acknowledging the creator and the world around us and things like that when I do openings and talk to people that are not of indigenous background. But I notice when the Maoris do it, they do it regardless of what room they're in or whoever's in the room with them. So it's just a part of their actual acknowledgement and way of life, which I think is fantastic. And I met with them not too long ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, at my First Nation. And I said, thank you. You just taught me something. Something I should do all the time is open with that acknowledgement and that respect for our history and our creator and our earth.
Right.
And so I thanked them I said, you just taught me something. So I should do that all the time, not just to people who don't understand.
Right. And they also identify themselves, their past generations. For example, my ancestry is Scottish. So, you know, should I go out to people and say, hi, I'm a white settler here in Canada, but my background is Scottish.
Which I found very interesting is they identified with certain waters and certain mountains, which I found extraordinarily interesting. We do the acknowledgement. See, I'm Mississaugas of the Credit. So I come from six communities that make up a Mississaugan nation. But we are all of the Anishinaabe people. So when you hear me talk and do acknowledgements, you won't hear me say very often Mississaugas of the Credit. You'll hear me say Mississaugas of the Anishinaabe. So paying tribute and honor to my ancestors who've come before me. And one woman asked me, every time I hear you say the word Anishinaabe, you always emphasize Anishinaabe. I said, because it's not just about me, it's about them too, and I want them to hear that, recognize that. So that's, and I never knew why I did it until she asked me. And then I said, oh, here's why I do it.
Right, right. And here in Canada, I don't know if it's part of the travel that we've had, but we opened our history books and we learned about the Hurons and the Iroquois and the Algonquin, and those terms don't seem to be used as much anymore. Are we getting better, or are they still just as applicable?
Well, you got to remember that the history books and my generation and the generation before me were taught out of Canadian history books. And so we never saw anything of ourselves in those stories or in those books. You know, I think that one of the most troubling things for me is that the Indigenous people have to come back and recognize the historical ties and familiar values that they once had with each other. See, right now you have Anishinaabe people from south to north, and in Ontario, they see each other as north and south, or as this community and this community, or as this PTO or this organization. That frustrates me. All I want them to do is come together and understand that we are the same people, and that'll go a long way in connecting us. And it's like, if we're competing for money or dollars, if our communities all need something, even if you need it worse than me, my job is to make sure I can do it for my family and my community. Well, every single person that we're talking about is still family and community. So that'll change the dynamic of how we help heal each other.
Right.
And I think that all the nations have to do that before we can come together as a conglomerate and say, we are the Indigenous people of this land. So we have to take a step back, reconnect, and build those ties to go forward. And I think that's where, you know, in some of the other nations you've talked about earlier are ahead of us. I think they've done that.
Mm-hmm. Finally, the federal government often throws out the fact that they're trying to, or they historically have dealt with all Indians as one, or all Inuit as one. And tell us why that's not true.
Well, the fact is that there's many nations who live on this land. There's many nations who walk this land in the past, and they're all different nations and different beliefs, different customs. You know, there's a history here in the Indigenous world that's rich with conflict and war, if you know anything about the history here, war and battles. And the way that the Indigenous people came to settle upon this land is different. And in those instances, the differences in the relationship with Canada are different. So it's very important that they understand that we are not one people. We are all individual nations, and we should be dealt with as individual nations. One of the problems I have with the Chiefs of Ontario organization that exists in Ontario is that it's a conglomerate of communities. It's not nationhood. If you want to have if that's to continue, the nations that live there must come together as nations and sit there and talk as nations. Until then, you'll just waste, in my opinion, Chiefs of Ontario can't do the job that's put in place to do until it comes back to that recognition. And so for Canada, it has to be the same thing. But Canada's not going to do that until we stand up and tell them that. And therein lies the problem.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Hey, how would you like a quick poem?
Okay.
I'll give you this one. I give this to everybody, and I say, I wrote this from the perspective of my people, but I want you to take it and use it and be the perspective of all people who come to this land. It's called, I'll just read it. I'll see if I can remember it. We are the keepers of these lands. She shelters and sustains us. Long after the flesh fails the spirit, we will care for these lands. Our drums will be heard upon the wind, our voices in the rustle of the leaves. Our people have a sacred trust of the land, a trust no man may break, a trust that death cannot sever. We were here when you first stepped foot upon this land, and here we will remain long after the last step has disturbed her soil. We wish.
Kevin Conrad is the executive director of the Coalition for Rainforest Nations. In 2004, he designed the Red Plus mechanism that is represented by Article 5 of the Paris Agreement. Mr. Conrad holds MBAs from both Columbia University and the London Business School.
My name is Kevin Conrad, and I founded the Coalition for Rainforest Nations.
Okay, and give us an idea how many nations are involved and what scope. Are we talking around the globe, or are we just talking about South America?
No, it's all the forest region. So the idea was, if we were going to stop deforestation, you couldn't stop it just in one country, because most of the drivers, which are either agriculture or logging, it's business. So if you stop in one country, they just move to another, cut a deal with the minister, and the deforestation continues. So the whole idea was to get almost every country that's in the tropical belt that has tropical forests involved, because otherwise you get sort of this competitive bidding, and we had to stop it, stop the multinationals from just moving from one country to another.
Right. Okay.
It's called Red Plus, and that was a sort of a silly name that came out by trying to describe what we're doing. So it means reduced emissions from deforestation. The second D is and degradation. And then the plus means, well, you can also conserve forests, you can sustainably manage forests, or you can plant trees. So Red Plus stands for basically stopping deforestation and degradation, conserving forests, or you know, basically taking care of forests and planting more trees. That was my thesis in grad school. The whole idea was, you know, I grew up in Papua New Guinea. I grew up sort of deep in the rainforest, and I learned, you know, sort of in a practical way, it's hard to deforest, right? I mean, it's hot. There are lots of bugs. There are snakes. There's all kinds of things. So you only cut down forests if there's an economic reason to do so. So, you know, how do we value forests more alive than dead? So, you know, they deforest to sell the wood and plant something on the earth. So if I could come up with a valuation. So we started, you know, looking around, and it seemed that carbon was the only global commodity that a forest, sort of a forest ecosystem service that I could, you know, figure out or sort of envision in the future could be traded anywhere. So that way I was giving rural communities sort of access to a global market. The only trouble was tropical forests were excluded from the Kyoto Protocol. And so I went to our prime minister in Papua New Guinea, and I said, hey, listen, your forests are actually more valuable for their carbon than the Chinese are paying for their wood. There's only one small problem. The carbon is excluded from the global climate negotiations. And he said, well, I should then withdraw. And I said, well, why don't you give us 2 years to try to change the rules? It's now 15 years later. It's the UN. It took us 15 years to get the 192 countries to agree to a set of rules. That's done, and so now we're in the process of implementing.
Okay. That's an excellent idea to reward countries to protect the natural environment. And there are pockets of that around in Europe and in North America where farmers are also, and I think it's because of that example, that it's not just the rainforest, but it's also just natural properties, that if you keep the wetlands, et cetera, then there's a value to it. And I think that's a key turning point in the world to understand that nature is not just that thing out there, that there is, it's a valuable resource unto itself.
Right. I mean, so what you're sort of speaking to is, we take nature's services for free, and we say thank you, but we're not sort of we're not really paying back nature, and we're not paying the stewards of those services. So if you have an indigenous community that's keeping the forest, why aren't you paying them for the service that forest is providing globally? And give them an incentive rather than just having NGOs run around and say, don't do something. Why don't you pay them if they're successful and do it? Whether it's farmers, ranchers, you know, forest people, whatever it is, we need to switch our incentive systems to make it positive.
Right. Now, in your presentation today, you mentioned something in the order of, if we planted 1 billion trees, that would reverse almost a decade of emissions.
a billion hectares of trees.
Okay, a billion hectares.
Yeah, so what we're just working with a team that analyzed this now. So they took the latest satellite images and looked at all the land that has been deforested by humans over time, but now lays sort of underutilized, right? And they said, well, what if we went back and replanted all those areas? What would it mean? So they identified using computer AI, that still needs to be ground checked, but they identified about a billion hectares of land that we've deforested and then not really done much with, and it just sort of sits there. And the idea then was, if we sort of tried to return that to its pristine forested state, what would that mean from a carbon emission standpoint? And those, that amount of trees would wipe out the last 10 years of carbon emissions from fossil fuels if we could do it. The question is, how? Which species? There are a lot of questions.
Yeah.
But that's sort of what I like to use that, because that's the theoretical possibility. And the question is, how far towards that goal can we get?
Right, right. We're constantly told that we need to have goals and objectives, something to aim for, rather than just, oh, we've got to do the right thing, oh, we've got to recycle.
Right.
So that's a hard and fast number. That's great. You also mentioned that we should keep fossil fuel in the ground.
And yes.
That's a pretty controversial statement, especially here in Canada.
Well, my point was not to make a policy statement. It was to state a fact. And the fact is that if you look at the carbon emissions in our existing fossil fuel reserves, and if they go up in the atmosphere, their direct impact on climate change. So my statement was to maintain global climate change at 1.5 degrees, about 80% of the world's coal, 50% of the world's natural gas, and 30% of their oil has to stay in the ground. So it doesn't have to, but then we're dealing with 2 degrees, right? And we also put up a slide that, well, what's the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees? Why should we care? And, you know, some of the things are that, you know, the average drought is going to be, at 1.5 would be 2 years. At 2 degrees is 4 years. 14% of people are going to be experiencing superstorms versus 37%. So a half a degree doesn't sound like much, but when it comes to climate, it's a big deal.
Yeah. Now, Collision, for the most part, is a high-tech conference.
Yeah.
Why are you here? What, other than the fact that someone already told me, because they invited me, why are you here? What do you see the benefit of speaking to the high-tech conference?
Well, you know, one of the first challenges we had when I was trying to set up an incentive system for countries to conserve their forests was, well, how do you measure and how do you monitor? So how do you know if someone has actually conserved their forest? And satellites and technology are part of that. So, you know, we relied on technology to create a global mechanism. So for me, I have a healthy respect for the use of technology as it relates to the conservation of environment, one. But beyond that, you know, as we all start to think about a carbon-constrained future, and I know that may be a novel concept in Canada, but, you know, we all need our personal carbon footprints, and I'm making a pledge to try to leave the world having removed more carbon than my life put into the atmosphere. And so in order to do that, I've got to have technology to track my carbon footprint, and then I've got to have technology that allows me, where do I get those removals so that I can offset myself and basically leave this world carbon negative. And so a lot of technology is key to all of that.
Okay. And if people want to find out more about your coalition, where can they go?
We have a website. It's CFRN.org, so Coalition for Rainforest Nations, CFRN.org. You know, we're not really techie people, so it doesn't provide that much information other than to tell you a little bit about what we're doing.
And how people can get involved or donate.
We have a donate button, but, you know, we want partners. So, you know, this only works if people can collaborate together and bring what we do. You know, we set up a global regime, and now we've got to take it local.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Los Angeles-based visual artist Diana Cohen is the CEO and co-founder of Plastic Pollution Coalition, a global alliance of over 750 organizations, businesses, and leaders working toward a world free of plastic pollution and its toxic impacts.
Hi, I'm Diana Cohen. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Plastic Transformation Coalition. We're a global coalition. I'm based in California, but we're international. We're over 750 businesses and NGOs around the world all working to stop plastic pollution and to raise awareness about the toxic impact on human health, animal health, the ocean and waterways, and the environment.
So much of the discussion around plastic pollution is about consumer habits and also, of course, about the industry that makes these products, right? So my first question is your sense of how can we incentivize consumers to change their habits? Please feel free to jump in. It's a big one, you know?
It's a big one, but it's an important one. How can we incentivize consumers? Well, I think that we have to move in this direction because many people are still unaware that plastic is primarily made from petroleum. And so as we move to divest from our dependence on fossil fuels, it's going to be really important to also move into other materials and using other packaging for our food and beverages, as well as the fact that petrochemical and many plastics have additives in them, bisphenols and phthalates, and those chemicals are endocrine disruptors. So they impact the health of our systems and our bodies for humans and also for animals. So it's going to be really important for us to change that and incentivize it. And some of the key ways we've seen that happening are by businesses like Lollyware and other companies that are part of our coalition working to provide alternative materials that people can use right now. We don't have to wait for a future that doesn't exist yet. The future's now, and we need to step up and embrace those changes now. I carry my own reusable things with me every day, bamboo utensils. I'm kind of like an urban backpacker, so.
I like that expression, urban backpacker. It's the first time I've heard it. So I have been seeing and reading about direct consumer action. Like some people say we should boycott petrochemical products. I've seen people leave packaging in stores. Do you foresee that happening more and more, and what's driving that?
It's actually happening right now. For Plastic Pollution Coalition, one of the first campaigns that we ran, we're turning 10 this year as well, so thanks. One of the first campaigns that we created was called the Refuse Campaign. So the idea was to take the model of the 3 R's that we teach our kids in school, reduce, reuse, recycle, and add refuse onto the front of that. So empower people and educate them so that whenever possible, they can refuse single-use plastic and look for alternatives, bring their own containers with them, frequent or patronize restaurants, cafes, bars, establishments that really reinforce and incentivize using real ceramic mugs, real glasses, bringing your own container. And we're watching business do that. They don't communicate it that well, but companies like Starbucks and Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf and Pete's actually incentivize it. If you walk in with your own reusable cup, they will give you 10 or 20 cents off every time you come in for a coffee. Most people don't know that, and they don't advertise it, but that is incentivizing a behavior change, and once you know about it, you become part of the solution. You're not contributing to the problem anymore.
May I add to that, actually? So we also have been developing for the last 2 years a global plastic reduction toolkit, and it's a beta version on our website, but people are welcome to use it if you'd like to. It's at plasticpollutioncoalition.org under resources. We are being contacted multiple times per week by people across the United States and around the world who are looking for language to add into policy and legislation that they're working on. So it's really exciting.
Deanna, do you want to wrap up a little bit by telling us a little bit about your work building coalitions to get policy passed? I thought that was very interesting. I also noted, of course, I spoke about that a little bit before, that there are no petrochemical companies in your coalition, but you still seem to have been able to make coalitions and pass some interesting legislation or at least proposals. So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I would say for us, creating a coalition, and when we first built Plastic Pollution Coalition, our second year we were only 25 groups. It was, I think, 3 businesses and all the rest were NGOs.
It's been a long, slow process, but it's been an interesting process. And our second year, the Girl Scouts of America joined us the same day that the Teamsters joined. But I'm not really aware of coalitions that have that diverse of a makeup to them. What we've been able to do is help amplify a common message, which is to get the world talking about plastic and plastic pollution. Not marine debris, not litter, not rubbish, not waste, not garbage. This isn't about keeping something beautiful. This is about using the tools that we've been able to build. Brand audits, adding brand audits onto cleanup so that you can turn around and talk to companies and say, hi, we just did this cleanup in Manila Bay, and guess what? Nestle's and Unilever, you were the two biggest corporate polluters on this beach. Or, hi, we've just done a cleanup last year for World Cleanup Day. It was a bunch of different coalition members and groups around the world, and from that data came the fact that Coca-Cola was the largest polluter out of 237 cleanups. So these are just facts. So we're creating tools and facts that can be used to turn around and then have a conversation with these companies.
And how is that conversation going?
It's going really well. It's going really well. They see the writing on the wall. There are now these two big funds. One of them was created by the petrochemical industry. I think they pledged $1.5 billion, which is not very much money for them. to begin to address, it's the alliance to address ocean waste or something like euphemistic like that. But I mean, it's a good sign to see things turning in that direction. And this evening, actually, in New York, will be the press conference for the release, the launch of Loop. It's L-O-O-P, and it's a kind of milkman delivery business model that's being launched that was created by TerraCycle, and we'll be part of that as well.
Deanna, why Collision? Why come to a tech conference?
Because they invited me. No, why Collision? I'm really interested in the planet tech component of Collision and the Collision Conference and how we get business and tech to understand that if they don't pay attention to sustainability and build that into the model for every single thing that they're creating, that we will have no future planet to live on for their company to prosper in.
So all the different issues that the environmentalists can look at, why are you focused on plastics?
Well, I'm focused on plastic for two reasons. One, I'm a visual artist, and I've just spent the last 29 years making artwork out of plastic bags that I cut up and sew back together and showing them in galleries and foundations and museums. So I've come to gain a better understanding of the material. And what I've come to understand is that when we design things that are meant to be used single use out of it or with intended obsolescence, it's a highly irresponsible use of a valuable material, which is made from petroleum and plastic.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. Email us at earthmatters@newsandcomment.com. News, A-N-D, comment.com.